Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Wow.
Hello and welcome to the Abroad in Japan podcast, probably the best way of learning about life in Japan without actually being in Japan. I'm your host, Chris Broad, and this week we're joined, as always, by Pete Donaldson, Japan's biggest enthusiast. How you doing, Pete?
I love it when you're a little bit green and you've not really done a show with me for a little while. You get a little bit confused about what my intro is. But you, look, change it up. Change it up. Forget my name. I don't care, mate. I've got a different look these days. I've got a little moustache. I've got a ponytail. It's all going off.
You look like you've just come out of the 1960s, the late 1960s. But to be fair, that's not the reason that I screwed up the opening. The reason I screwed up the opening is today I went outside. This morning I opened the news up and it said there was going to be lots of smog today in Japan. Now, obviously lots of smog in East Asia typically because China's the factory of the world. But we don't normally get it here because some of the air currents kind of push it all away and we avoid it. But apparently there was like a smog warning. I was like, there isn't going to be smog. Nonsense. Went out the front door and it is smog. It is.
Wow.
There's so much smog. Like, I couldn't see the sun. It was behind this sort of yellow haze.
Oh,
the town of like Sendai, everything was just gone. And it's not done me much good. As a mild asthmatic, it's a terrible thing to happen. But
it's something that kind of, I think, living in London for a long time, and I'm a pretty extreme asthmatic. I got my jab pretty early on, my COVID jab, and I'm going for my second in about 3 or 4 weeks' time. Because it's quite bad. But I've never really I don't think I've ever experienced a whole lot of smog in London, even though that's got a bit of a reputation. But when you go to places like, I think I was in, it must have been Beijing. I remember sort of feeling, it feels really close, doesn't it? It feels really like, the smog clouds are really, really low and it really gets on your chest. It's very, very difficult to breathe.
Yeah, like they wear face masks there. I've been wearing them for decades just to sort of get through the smog. But like I've never really experienced it like this in Japan before. So it's been a weird day. At first I just thought, oh, you know, it's just clouds, but there's a sort of texture to it, an unpleasant texture. And it's just the yellow sort of the sun and the sort of the sky just looking this yellow color is quite unpleasant.
I wonder, because obviously the smog is just, you know, combustibles getting burned off or whatever. I wonder what products are in your lungs right now, like where the particles came from. Trainers or I don't know, like an arcade machine or something, like what, like, or just a bit of like PVC piping for a house, like what part of industry is in your lungs right now? There must be so many different products dancing around in your lungs.
It's probably my asbestos bath mats from Christmas. Remember
exactly,
those? That's what it is. They've come back, burnt to pieces. No, it's horrible though. It sounds like a game show. What's in your lungs? I dread to think.
Yeah, exactly.
And that would go for Natsuki. I mean, for Natsuki, it's just a normal day. Giving him smokes 30
Natsuki,
cigarettes.
Yeah, he probably feels free. He's probably like, well, this is a lot easier than smoking 30 a day. Oh, yo, yo.
It's horrible, but
smog.
To be fair, though, Japan, given it's a relatively small country, very densely populated, 125 million people, the air quality is really good here because they've got the Pacific air current and the Siberian winds. But sometimes it does come across from sort of the southwest, from sort of China. South Korea gets it the worst. If you go on an air quality index, just on a map, at the moment, like all of Japan's kind of yellow and red, and then Korea and China, just purple. That whole area is right. purple, and it's like very dangerous levels. But yeah, it's very, very bad.
Look after yourself, mate. Look after yourself. Get yourself one of those kind of is it N95 masks that we. I mean, I guess everyone's N95. Masked up anyway nowadays, so you probably don't experience it as bad as you might do.
Put on two masks and a spacesuit just to get through. But speaking of horror, a couple of weeks ago on this podcast, we had a story. A guy called Max who got on a podcast. He got on a roller coaster, and it turned out. He was overweight and they didn't let him on. I think that was the story. Do you remember vaguely what happened, Pete? That was it, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was just too big for the roller coaster, I suppose. They worried about him and took him off. They weighed him, didn't they? And then took him
off. They
did,
yeah. I think that was why the story was so ridiculous. Max was at the back of the queue. Some staff were like, come this way, young man. He was like, oh, wow, I've been upgraded to the front of the roller coaster. And they ushered him to the front of the roller coaster to a scale, put him on the scale. And he was like, oh, it's not an upgrade. It's humiliation. And in front of like 50 people, they weighed him and then said no.
This is the day I get humiliated. Yeah. And so we've had a few like messages from people sort of experiencing being too hefty or too large. Heroi, no, not Heroi, what was Futoi for a roller coaster.
Oh, Japanese knowledge, he still remembered it. We got one this week from Liam, and Max, unfortunately, was a little bit overweight. And to be fair, Japanese roller coasters are built to a slightly different standard, I think. But Liam was too tall, and his story begins, G'day, Chris and Pete, listening to the trials and tribulations of poor Max and the lad that wasn't permitted onto a roller coaster, I thought I'd share a tale as to my own experience with being a larger lad on a roller coaster and why these checks are probably in place for the weight. My friend and I took on the roller coaster atop the buildings at Tokyo Dome City. This roller coaster goes through the buildings and over the streets below. I've always wanted to go there. You know what? I've never been to Tokyo Dome. Have you been around there?
No. Whereabouts is it?
It's like the coolest venue. It's kind of like in between Akihabara and Shinjuku, but it's in this like weird bit of Tokyo that I've just never needed to go through.
Oh, is it where the Tokyo Dome where they do the baseball? Is that the Tokyo Dome?
They might do. I know a lot of big musicians play there, like Hyde from Larkin's Hill. But
it's
like a theme park with a roller coaster in the middle of Tokyo. I don't know how I've never gone. Anyway, Liam continues. My friend is 6'6" and stocky, 115 kilograms, and I am a 6'3" and a solid 110 kilograms. But we were pumped as we got to the front of the car, by far the best place to truly experience a roller coaster. Mm. We took our seats, and as the safety bar came down to lock us in, we were instructed to push the bar over our legs. Given that these rides are probably made for the more petite Japanese people, this proved to be rather difficult. After a brief struggle, we only managed to get one solitary, stubborn click on the safety latch. Given all the other people around us were getting 10 to 20 clicks, the staff decided that this would not suffice and stalled the entire ride. A small gentleman came to try and secure us further by pushing all of his weight onto the bar. Four more staff joined the push party. A sight to see for all the locals behind us, I'm sure. We got two more clicks on the latch, which was determined to be safe enough. On one sharp right turn towards the end of the ride, gravity forced my friend's weight down on me, and we heard a click and felt the bar loosen. We both looked at each other to confirm we'd both felt it. For the rest of the ride, we desperately held the safety bar to our bodies, hoping that we weren't about to be hurled from the ride. What felt like an age later, we pulled into the base, and I saw at least one staff member happy to see us both there. It could have all been in our heads, but after that experience, it's easy to see why they do need to have size limits on rides in Japan. We went straight to the bar and drank until we could laugh about the whole experience. Thanks for letting me share. Liam from Perth. What do we make of that?
From one bar to the other. I mean, I like the fact that they were going, right, okay, so they got three clicks in total, and then had one click removed while they were on the ride. Just sort of going, right, how many have we got in the bank? How many clicks have we got in the bank? Oh, God.
It is ominous, isn't it? It is ominous,
but I think it's very strange that, like, you know, Australia and are they from Australia? Have I just sort of made that up? Yeah, they start the goddamn email with a good day, for crying out loud. Liam does. Yeah, like, I don't know what it is about, like, Australia and New Zealand, but, like, like guys are just built like fucking farmhands. They're just massive, tall men, like, gigantic kind of wrestlers. Yeah, and it's really close to, like, Singapore and Japan and China. I don't understand why they make such big men in New Zealand and Australia. It's very strange. What's going on down there?
It's the popularity of rugby.
You can't make someone bigger. Why is everyone so big? Why are all like the lads in Clapham just massive, the Aussies? Absolutely insane.
If you're from Australia and New Zealand, tell us, why are you so big? Why are you so strong?
Why are you so big?
Have you come off a roller coaster in Japan? To be fair, and it's a point of comfort for our taller listeners or those of you that worry that you're not going to fit onto a Japanese roller coaster, I've never heard a story of anyone foreign dying or flying off of a roller coaster. It's not like the one in the UK where everyone got their legs chopped off a few years ago because the roller coaster broke. I remember
that was not ideal.
I was at Alton. I was at Thorpe Park, which is one of the biggest theme parks in the UK, just by London. Mm. And there was a ride there called Saw, I think, the Saw ride. And the roller coaster, just before, it goes up really high and then it sort of goes over the top and goes down almost vertically. It's a vertical drop of a few carriages. It got to the top of the ride, the peak, and just as it was about to go over the top, it stopped, it broke. And I remember they're up there for like 45 minutes, just like peering down over the edge, the precipice of this roller coaster. Like, that is true horror. That is the ultimate roller coaster, sitting there for 40 minutes, not knowing when the moment's going to come that you're going to go throwing over the edge.
It must just be like a safety mechanism. Because like the ones that are in like Thorpe Park, these are roller coasters. It's like Universal Studios or Disney or whatever. Mm. It's like these are resident. It's not like a dodgy carnival that just turns up in your town and then fucks off after killing people and it goes to the next town. I went on one the weekend called the Master Blaster, which is just a big long seat that sort of rotates really quickly. And I think I'm getting a bit old. I was like, that was a bit much, to be honest. I got very excited about going on it.
Rotates quickly.
It's just a seat
dreadful.
That rotates quickly. It was pretty.
Could do that in the comfort
sedate.
Of your own apartment. You could do that in the comfort of your own home, Pete, on your spinny desk chair.
My spinny desk chair. Yeah. Oh, awful business.
But yeah, take comfort, folks. If you come to Japan, nothing bad has happened. I guess maybe a lot of people just get turned away. Yeah. Keep an ear out for those clicks. Got a story this week. A few stories. One of the stories that we, you know, every now and then a story breaks from Japan and it goes global and everyone messages us about it to cover it. And we've had one this week involving a squid statue. Have you heard about this gigantic squid statue, Pete? Did it make it to the UK on the BBC?
Certainly did. And to be honest, all of the equal Japanophiles got in touch on Twitter and sent it our way as well, because I was CC'd in. An astonishing bit of bad council work. I cannot believe what I love it. I absolutely love it. It's like as if we were the mayor. Like, look, this is what we need. This is what we need. We need a big statue of a squid.
It is bonkers. So there's a coastal town, right? It's called Noto, and it's near Kanazawa. And I've never been there, but I've had Noto beef, Noto gyu. I've always found that really inconvenient to say. I remember there was a video I did on Journey Across Japan, literally 3 days before you turned up, when we were going through Kanazawa, and there was a street market selling Noto gyu and Noto sort of wagyu. And it was just really awkward being like, oh, I'll have the Noto beef. It's like, not beef? Yeah, not beef, not beef. It's just bloody inconvenient. But now they've done something worse than that. They've literally built a statue of a giant squid that cost $230,000 using federal COVID-19 relief money. It's a 43-foot statue of a flying squid. It is rather big, and it is nicely done. Is it worth $200,000? I'm not so sure. Was that a good use of money, given the situation in Japan at the moment? The whole COVID situation is not going well. The town was given $6.2 million in coronavirus relief money. They spent $2.5 million of that on infection control, $1.3 million to promote local businesses, and they spent $200,000 on a giant squid statue, the idea being that people would come from far and wide to see the squid. And this place is famous for squid, to be clear. Not that I've ever had squid from there that I know of. But yeah, I'm in two minds about this. On the one hand, not great timing, really, is it, to have a statue like this when beds are filling up around the nation and whatnot. Mm. On the other hand, I don't know when the decision was made. Maybe it was made at a time when you know, made about 6 months ago when things weren't so bad, because things have certainly picked up recently. I don't know. All I know is I hate giant squid, so I'm not really enthusiastic about it.
Do you not think, I mean, it's just a bigger version of the ones you sort of see on like Dotonbori in Osaka on the front of shops. I mean, it does look as shit as that, but it's just so bloody big. And that's the thing with like sort of local councils in Japan. They seem to like, if they do get a bit of money, they sort of go, let's make a mascot for something. Let's make another mascot that looks exactly the same as every other mascot. But it is a massive rendition of a squid. Is there a hole? It seems to be a hole where its mouth is. Can he climb in it?
I don't actually. I don't know what's in that hole. I don't know if I want to find out. Back to your point with the old mascots, though. I think if you're going to invest in something as a local tourism agency or whatever, I think a mascot's a good idea to some respects. Like, you know, remember Kumon the bear that's generated $1 billion for the local economy. And I'm trying to think of any others, because that's the only one that usually has done well.
The baseball team, John Oliver. Oh, I don't know. Is there a fish? There's a fish. Sakana, something no Sakana is one that is the Chiba Lotte baseball mascot, and he just transforms all the time. Like he'll sort of just explode, and there'll be a little man inside with a little microphone, and it's
sounds
amazing. He just reinvents himself every few weeks. It's great.
I did cover that in the video a few years ago. And there's Melon Bear, my personal favorite, Melon Bear, which is a bear with a melon for a head. And he looks absolutely terrifying. And there's a great video of like a children's daycare center in Hokkaido. And then Melon Bear just turns up and goes, "Roar!" And all the kids are crying and running away.
Into it at all.
I love it. The story for Melon Bear, they have a little like crappy origin story for these mascots. And Melon Bear's story is he's a bear that ate too many melons and then became Melon Bear. Too many of the tasty, delicious local melons.
Yeah, what's the message here? Don't eat too many of our melons. They're very precious and you'll turn into a fucking melon.
Well, he's the representative of Yubari, where you remember Yubari King Melons, the sort of $1,000 melons, which I to sink my teeth into. But going back to the squid, I don't know if it's money well spent. I'm sure, I mean, if I gave you $200,000 to promote like a town or something, what would you spend it on? How would you invest?
I would get a task force together, find the worst people in the town and push them into the sea.
Walk the plank scenario.
Yeah. Pirate just sort of go, right, okay, you've had it too good for too long. Let's clean this town up. You're the worst. You just spat on the floor. You're out. Get in the sea. Just push them all in the sea. My task
walk
force.
The Donaldson Plank. But, I mean, this town's got 16,000 residents. It's about 180 miles northwest of Tokyo. It's only a matter of time before I'm drafted in, no doubt, to promote this town by some weird local government authority.
I agree.
Ryota and I will be going there, probably trying to be enthusiastic about a squid, but I don't know. I think they could have spent that on better things, to be honest, but time will tell. I think it'll just sort of... Obviously, it's in the global media at the moment, but I think it will just be swept under a rug and everyone will forget about it quickly.
Oh, is it? How many YouTubers have already gone there, though? How many sort of...
well, none yet. Bloggers, none yet.
Geobloggers.
But that'll
soon
be. It'll soon be Ryotaro. Watch the space. Ryotaro's Japan. That is a Ryotaro's Japan video waiting to happen. But credit where it's due to Noto. They do have good beef. So you stick to the Noto beef here and avoid the squid.
Oh, there you go.
On the subject of sushi, though, we've got another story this week. A recent survey of 15,500 diners found that 6,000 people, 40%, said... Is that 40%? Yes, 40% said they always add wasabi to the fish on their sushi and never make wasabi joyu. So basically, when you go out for sushi, a lot of people... You get your soy sauce naturally to dip your sushi in, and then you get the wasabi and you... Now, a lot of people dip the wasabi into the soy sauce and sort of mix it together into this paste known as wasabi joyu. And
So it's got a name, has it? Right.
It's almost like a soupy kind of, it's kind of a soup, I guess. And I mean,
salty,
do you do it?
Hot soup. I do, because the stuff that you get in itsu is like terrible soy sauce and even worse kind of fake horseradish wasabi. So, I mean, you are not spoiling the flavors mixing those two fuckers together.
And that's a fair point. And that is my philosophy for kind of 100 yen sushi restaurants or conveyor belt sushi, right?
Yeah.
There's a bit of study conducted to see what proportion of people actually do that. So 40% said they always add wasabi to the fish on their sushi and never make this kind of wasabi soy sauce. However, 27% said they mix the wasabi in with their soy sauce, and 30% said they do it depending on the situation, making the practice common with over half of the respondents. So all the good sushi restaurants will kill you if you add real wasabi to soy sauce, because as you mentioned a minute ago, most wasabi is fake, right? It's horseradish stuff. It's horrible. Whereas proper decent wasabi from the root, if you mix that with soy sauce, it doesn't really, just doesn't work, because like real wasabi root tastes really nice, but it doesn't have a strong sort of kick to it that you get from artificial wasabi. So if you go to a good restaurant, don't dip your fish in soy sauce and don't put your wasabi in the soy sauce, because they'll do it for you, right? They'll sort of stroke seems like the wrong word. What's the word?
Caress. Laminate.
They'll spray the soy sauce on the fish.
Nobody wants spray. Good lord.
They'll brush the soy sauce.
There we go.
Not douse, not stroke. They'll put it on the top right. And they'll put the wasabi underneath the fish. And that's the way to do it. But I think it's fair game. If you go into like a cheap, crappy sushi place, then it's fine. Do it, because
it takes the edge off the soy sauce. It makes it creamier. And it kind of like, it's very pleasant.
Gives the soy sauce a bit of a kick, doesn't it? Because that kind of artificial wasabi is not great. No. It needs to be sort of mixed with the soy sauce. But there you go. I've always wondered what the proportion of people doing that was. But there you go. 30% said they'd do it depending on the situation. So I think most people are on the same boat as us. We'll be back in a minute to go to the fax machine.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? Mine's pretty low after coming back from the craziness of WrestleMania, too many body slams and all that. And I'm pretty jealous of my co-host Chris, who seems to have been exploring Japan's most isolated hotel. He's definitely winning in the relaxation race, but I'm determined to catch up with him. It can be easy to get swept up in social gatherings and spread ourselves too thin, but with therapy, you can learn to prioritize your time and recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/Japan today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Japan.
And we're back to the fax machine. What do we got this week, Mr. Dawson?
Sorry. Right.
God, that's terrible. You got smog. All right.
Dear Chris and Pete, hello from San Francisco. Long time listener, first time caller, or perhaps faxer. This is from Nate. Like many others, I've been itching to return to Japan and have had my plans foiled by the pandemic. However, we're lucky to have one of the most vibrant Japanese-American communities in the country. I've been able to scratch some of my itch through the great Japanese food here, as well as stuff like our local Hanami Festival. My question, do either of you have any favourite spots back home in the UK that remind you of your Japanese travels, or scratch the same itch thanks to the great podcasts and videos? Nate, you got any big Sakana Tears that you recommended to me? Has been a lovely little sushi restaurant in sort of Piccadilly. Any of the spots around Piccadilly are really, really nice.
Yeah, there's a good Japanese restaurant called Engawa. I don't remember exactly where it is. I think it's near Soho. Near
it's in Ham Yard. Yeah. It's in Ham Yard, and it's one of the few places in town that does proper Wagyu.
That's right. Because I remember when I went back to the UK for a few months in between teaching and YouTube stuff, I was on the hunt for some good Japanese food, and I wanted to have some Wagyu. Kind of Japanese beef, but very hard to get it in London. Very hard. And Engawa was one of the only places that had kind of A5 amazing Wagyu. And it's not overly cheap, but for a special occasion, it's rather good. But yeah, I'd say kind of that whole area around the back of Chinatown, we've got this sort of Asian restaurants and stuff. I mean, that's where all the best Japanese restaurants in London are. And it's the only place in the UK where you can see like kanji characters around and about on buildings. So, yeah, we don't really have much in the UK in that regard. Compared to, like, the US and the West Coast, we don't really have much Japanese culture in the UK other than that area.
Well, look at even, like, the Chinatowns around the world. Like, we have a very underwhelming Chinatown in London. I mean, it's bigger in bloody Manchester or Birmingham, to be honest. But, it's not huge. Very sort of packed in. But, the Japan Centre around the back of Piccadilly as well. Yeah, yeah. That's a little supermarket that sells lots of great sake and just raw materials for cooking and stuff.
Raw materials. Copper, oil,
that's what
iron.
I call it.
Get it at the Japan Centre. We got one here from Habib who says, "Hi, Chris and Pete. Considering some of the comments Chris has made before about his reasons for leaving the UK, like escapism and wanting to try something different, and also his comments about British people being quite defeatist when it comes to entrepreneurial ideas, I wondered if he also has anything to say about classism in the UK and how it compares to Japan. As a fairly bright, mixed-race Londoner from a fairly working-class background, class has always weighed heavily on me. Certain levels of academic and professional attainment are spoken of as if they're only reserved for entitled Oxbridge graduates. Do you notice anything similar in Japan? Are there class identifiers? Do people look down on others regardless of their actual intelligence or how nice they are, based on their accent, appearance, or where they went to school? Thank you for the podcast videos. I discovered your work mid-lockdown last year and never looked back. Thanks, guys. Habib." That's an interesting question. Have you got any thoughts on that first, Pete?
The whitest man in town, and I certainly am quite familiar with, and certainly coming from the north, quite familiar with how certain sort of identifiers when it comes to what people you're working with, you sort of realize, oh right, okay, this is how you were able to afford to live in London on a very, very small wage because you've got outside kind of finances I think sort of going to visit mates who were in, like, my mate went to Peterhouse in Cambridge, and he was one of about five kids in the whole of the school who was suggested they might want to apply to an Oxbridge college. And he got in, and sort of walking around sort of with him around Peterhouse and sort of talking to, obviously, you know, you're 18, I'm at a university in Leicester, he's in university at Cambridge, and I'm chatting to his friends. And his friends, like, they've all got, like, they all had worse exam results than I did. But because they came from private school, it was obviously assumed that you would end up in Oxbridge, you would end up in one of the red brick universities, but for me. But obviously my lived experience is very different to someone who isn't white. It's frequently, if I was a person of color, I would very much, it would fucking rankle with me, to be quite frank, that I wouldn't be necessarily regarded as first in the queue to join any sort of club. I mean, obviously I'd be further in the queue cause I'm white, but like, yeah, if I'm feeling it, I cannot imagine what the experiences of
my main takeaway from that story is your exam results were very good, and you were secretly
they were excellent.
About
yeah, that's what I'm yeah. A in history, baby. Well, you know, I'm just saying. Like, I mean, predicted D, got an A. Up yours, Mr. Lee.
I had a teacher called Mr. Lee as well.
Mr. Lee was very nice, actually. It was funny, the other one who predicted me bad.
My school was like over the road from a private school. And for our school trips, it was always like, we're going to the farm again. And we'd be like, oh. And the school across the road would be like, we're going to Algeria. Yeah. Like, oh. It really sucks. I mean, I'm from like a working class sort of background. My parents, both kind of working class. And yeah, I was always very aware of class in the UK. I was lucky I went to a grammar school, which you have to pass a few tests to get into. It's not a private school, but I find that most people there were sort of a few classes higher than me. And it definitely weighed on me a little bit. But it does exist in Japan. I think the only thing Japan has in its favor is people don't look down upon others as much, maybe. There's not as much snobby kind of behavior, I feel. Like, people are a bit more accepting. Mm. You know, whatever people's jobs, we sort of accept that over here. But no, it does exist. Like, you do have the sort of political elite in Japan who their parents and their family have been in politics, and then they're sort of destined to go in there, going to big universities like Tokyo, and there's a few private ones. But there is definitely a class structure here. No two ways about it.
And there's that kind of class as the Barakumin, the Korean kind of Korean extraction kind of underclass that are treated like kind of pariahs, and they sort of remember those ones that are like, there's not that many. It's not as visible as it used to be, but they're kind of regarded as, I think it literally means hamlet people. They're literally regarded as sort of being like villagers who live in cities and stuff, and they just treated like kind of they're a little backward. Hamlet people. Very enjoyable.
I love Shakespeare. But generally, though, I'd say Japan, while it does have a class structure, it's not as pervasive as the UK historically. But I don't know. I'm not really an expert on the subject, so I don't feel like I should be qualified to discuss it. One thing I will say is the UK probably has better social mobility than Japan. I feel like in Japan, it's quite harder to switch classes or to switch groups. It's very hard to switch careers and jobs. Which is something I've seen Natsuki struggle with over the years. He would love to do lots of other things, but he's destined to run a beauty salon. And he's finding it very hard to get away from that, because most people just don't switch jobs or switch careers in Japan, right? Whereas in the UK, it's a little bit easier to do that. But yeah, we'll have to do a bit more research on that and definitely cover it in a bit more detail on another occasion. Take it away, Mr. Dawson.
We got a message from Orville. Hello, Orville. Hello, Chris and Pete. Short question for Pete. Your podcast company that oversees the Football Ramble and Abroad in Japan is called Stakhanov, and I'm curious as to where the name comes from. That's it. Ooh. Short and sweet. Thanks. Lovely little short email from Orville. Well, Stakhanov. it was an old school ex-Soviet, well, just Soviet propaganda sort of, I'd say tool, but it's just basically this guy who under, I think it was Stalin, actually, rather distastefully, and I think that's why we're going to probably change on him at some point, if we're completely honest with ourselves. He was this guy, he was this miner who dug out more rocks than anyone else, like dug out more coal than anyone else.
Really?
And he was kind of up. He was kind of up as like a poster boy under Soviet rule. That was like, you know, the idea that hard work is great for the nation and stuff like that. So Stakhanov, Alexander Stakhanov, I think he was held up as being this kind of like this great guy because he dug more coal and worked hard than anyone else. He set the record for digging more coal than any other man.
And you relate to that.
And I think. To be honest, it was like a holding company for a long time. Like when we were doing the Ramble stuff, like it was, we just had that company kicking around. And when we wanted to do new podcasts like Wrestle Me and, the apparently excellent Abroad in Japan podcast, we thought, well, just fucking, we'll just call it Stakhanov and then figure out something, later down the line. We will change it at some point, I'm sure. It's an interesting kind of little kind of Russian tale, or like folk tale, effectively, and it sums us up as being, you know, bloody hardworking and absolute bloody legends.
I like you've got a really thought provoking story behind your brand name about a Russian coal miner, and I'm just born in Japan. It's funny, it's clever because it's my name, Chris Broad. It's a pun, isn't it? That's all I've got. That's all I've got.
Yeah.
Great Russian stories for me. But no, you can't change it. Stakhanov's a cool name.
I think I'm
What are you going to call it? Pete's Happy Company.
I'm sort of quite. I think we'll probably just short it to Stack, but and it will probably happen Stack. Sooner rather than later. But I think, you know, it's nice to have that lineage that started with a reason. You know, we're hardworking, we're industrious, and more than anything else, I think Russian history is kind of like in general, like people don't necessarily kind of talk about it. People kind of steer away from Slavic names, I would say, in brands because they're seen as somehow, you know, untrustworthy business wise. And I think I'm proud of the name. I'm proud of using like a Slavic name for a company personally. So, yeah, we'll probably show it at some point because, to be honest, people can't fucking say it half the time.
Stakhanov.
People say Stakhanov. And to be honest, like, people shorten it to Stack all the time, so that's probably what we'll go for in the end. So stay tuned.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen. A masterclass in branding from Pete Donaldson. He's not just a podcast guy with a ponytail. He's a master of branding. Slavic name businesses. We got one here from Bread. Literally sincere.
Bread. Nice.
Hi, Chris and Pete. I love that we've gone through all these big discussions about class and branding, and now we've got a message from Bread. Hi, Chris and Pete. Greetings from Orange County, California. How are you guys doing today? We're doing very well, Bread. We're doing very well. I'm planning on attempting a biking trip across Japan based on your experience a few years ago. Are you now? Better not steal my brand name. What's your advice for someone that doesn't have the luxury of having a team to check on you for your safety during the trip? Will I die? Will Google Maps fail me? Looking forward to hearing from you guys. Sincerely, Bread. Also, I'd like to see another Abroad in Japan video in Okinawa. I go there about once a year, and I feel like you would love to see what the countryside of the island has to offer. Thank you very much, Bread. I would like to go back to Okinawa. Any excuse to go to a beach. My advice for someone who doesn't have the luxury of having a team to go with them on the trip is, you know what? I think Journey Across Japan, if I wasn't filming it every day, it would have been fairly painless and a lot of fun. But because I was filming it, I wasn't just cycling like every day. I was having to think of a story, and that's where it gets really difficult. I'd say just use cheap hotels. We did stay in a lot of cheap accommodation on Journey Across Japan. Like you might remember, Pete, on your kind of 4 or 5 days, we stayed exclusively pretty much in upper hotels, which are kind of like the cheapest hotels you can get that still have a bed and a pillow and running water. Stick with upper hotels. And, yeah, don't use paper maps, as Pete and I quickly discovered on our trip.
They dissolve pretty quickly. I mean, you say that, like, if you didn't have a team to look after you, look after your welfare. I was like, I was on that trip, and I don't remember the team looking after our welfare.
They did just drive off.
We left our own devices.
They just sort of drove off 30 kilometres down the road. We had to catch up with them. But, no, it was useful to have them there, even though I don't remember what they did. Did they? Yeah. They were useful. But good luck, though, Bread. Keep us informed. If you do make this pilgrimage, if you do make this trip on the bike, we'd love to hear more about it. I have had quite a few listeners and viewers message me over the years saying they've been kind of inspired by Journey Across Japan. They've sent like photos and a few people have done, you know, cross-country cycles. And I would love to see more folks do it because it was an incredible journey. And I would do it again at the drop of a hat, but I wouldn't film it. Never, ever again. Keep the stories, questions, comments coming into abroadinjapanpodcast@gmail.com. We'll be back to do it all over again on Wednesday. There you go.
Yes, good boy.
And we'll see you then, guys. But for now, have a great start to the week. Have a good one.
This was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces 3 thought-provoking questions over 3 glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.